Welcome back to Ed Says. Work, we all got to do it. Some of us enjoy it, others do not. I have my moments. I would much rather be lounging around doing nothing. And if you're not the boss, work can be that much harder, especially if you have a bad boss. And according to workplace culture expert Bobby Albert, there are four types of bad bosses, and he will tell us how to handle them. I have experienced bad bosses in the past. One in particular jumps out. When he took over, he made no effort to introduce himself before making a series of changes, and then had us all sit in a room with him for a meeting before introducing himself to us individually and read a children's book. That's just one instance. Joining us now is Bobby Albert, workplace culture expert. Good morning, Bobby. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
So I was just talking about how you said there are four types of bad bosses, and I was detailing one that I had. He came into our radio station that already had an established culture. Everybody who had been there was a very cohesive unit. And when he came in, he didn't introduce himself, and he just started making wholesale changes before introducing himself, and then had a staff meeting where he had all of us sit around his office and each read a page in a children's book about a steam shovel and how it had to change itself from a steam shovel to a boiler for the building. And I would rank him as a bad boss. Which of the four types would you call him?
Well, you know, that may be a little hard one, but it doesn't sound like one that's very exciting to work for. And that's the reason why, you know, that in a recent survey that 84% of the people say they work for a bad boss. And what I have found is that most people, they don't quit the company. They quit the boss or the supervisor. When they leave the company, it's the boss is the reason why they're leaving. And the exceptions are be like, you know, maybe there's the culture didn't fit, or perhaps maybe the position didn't help them in their strength area. But this, you know, what we're talking about here, what you experience is what I call the employee lament. And what that says is that we, the uninformed, working for the inaccessible, doing the impossible for the ungrateful.
Now that makes a lot of sense. It was a difficult time. Most places that I've worked in my history have been for 5 years. Like everywhere I've been, it's been 5 years, 5 years. That one was a little shorter because of this hire. I was asked to leave, not him, or I didn't leave of my own volition. And then the job that followed there was kind of just a filler job. But every other job, I've been able to stay. And it's not as though I haven't had bosses that I didn't agree with. And I think most people just suffer through it, because especially in this day and age, people need the paycheck.
Well, that's true. And, you know, the question is, how did that person get there to begin with? And what I have found and what I've observed is either a person, let's take like the best salesperson in an organization's been promoted to that position, or maybe someone was hired, like in your case, it sounded like somebody that was maybe hired from outside of the organization. And what I call this the myth of the 8 D's. And these are the reasons why they were hired to begin with, is they were found to be dedicated, dependable, demanding, doer, decisive, determined, deep thinker, and the last one is darn good. So the reason why they're classified as bad bosses, and not maybe this is a little different in your case, but in general, these people are really, they're good people with good intentions. But what happened is that the boss that hired them or their supervisor didn't prepare them, did not coach them, didn't even provide training on the skills of how you're going to lead all these people. So they end up coming in to this position thinking that they need to show their boss, the person that hired them, that they have these 8 D's, and they're driven for results.
And one of the things I noticed, you say they weren't prepared for the position they were given, and I think that's something that's systemic across business these days when it comes to training people. I think training used to be more comprehensive, and now it just seems like here's the job, figure it out. Is that something you've seen in your experience?
Well, you're exactly right. It's amazing that the cost of replacing a person in a position is a lot greater than most businesses realize, or bosses even realize. So the training part helps people, not only the frontline people, but these people in a supervisory capacity, is that, maybe let me say it this way, when they're not trained well, you see sub or chaotic results in the organization. But when they are trained properly, you'll find that this is a company that they are delighting their customers, and they're increasing profits at an extraordinary level. And that's what I saw in my own company when you do those things correctly.
And when it comes to having a boss, what gets better results? The boss that is I hate to use the word aloof, but detached and kind of dictates, or the boss that leads by example, is willing to roll up their sleeves and get in there with the employees? Which one tends to get better results, or does it depend on the industry?
You know, it's amazing you're asking that question, because that is a very profound question. Because I get asked often, what can I do to my people, rather than being asked, well, what can I do with my people to get them to be productive? That's the question I get asked most often. But it's not what you can do to your people. It is what you can do with your people. And in my company, we develop, it was the secret sauce in our company. We developed a participative management style, and that was what now I call engage to lead. And I'm writing about it right now on my website. So what I saw, when you got people to participate in the decision making process, that's where I saw our company have extraordinary results.
And Mr. Albert, do you think technology has been more of a help or a hindrance to companies when it comes to leadership and management?
Well, technology, from a training aspect, and that's one reason why I've got these online courses, but technology has been helpful to bring in the training tools. But what we're still talking about are people skills. And that really just kind of comes down to the heart of the issue is, do people in the leadership role have the skills, the people skills, to accomplish the goals of the organization?
Workplace culture expert Bobby Albert, thank you so much for your time, sir. It's an interesting discussion that I'm sure many people listening are smashing their head against the wall going, I have that boss that doesn't listen, that says, what can we do to rather than with?
Yes. Well, thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Have a wonderful afternoon. If you are in a leadership role, in a management role, do not ever purchase Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel and give it to the staff to pass around in a meeting and read to each other. That was the book. I had to Google it, but it really was one of the most disheartening moments in my career, where I have to go, I mean, I'm a grown person with years of experience in this industry, and you're having us read a children's book to get a point across. It was first published in 1939. It was 48 pages. We each got a page. The story was a man and his steam shovel face competition from modern motor shovels. And the steam shovel digs a hole, gets stuck, and becomes the boiler for the new building. And it's about changing and adapting. And it made me want to throw myself out a window onto the train tracks that were right across the street from our building. Because I don't know in whose mind you would ever think to have adults read a children's book as your first introduction to your staff. That's just me. Maybe I'm motivated differently. And it made me think of the Peter principle, where people rise to the level of their incompetence. And if I were wrong about this one, I would say that. But I wasn't. And this isn't, well, the hatred stems from bitterness from being fired from this individual. I'm big enough to say that. But looking at it objectively, when you get a group of veterans in the industry and adults in a room and have them read a children's book, you're not going to get off on the right foot. And then when you have them sit in your office for 2 hours to critique a four-hour talk show about how they should have done this, that, or this, when you contribute nothing creatively and fall short of every standard established for your position, I would say that I am right in saying that was a bad hire. But that's just me. And again, there might be some bitterness in there, but at the same time, I'm able to be critical. 888-574-2723 is the number in the studio. At Ed Says CT on Twitter, and Ed Says at talkofconnecticut.com is the email. Up next, we're going to look at the Affordable Care Act. Repeal is on its way. Replacement, there's a few options. How it will affect Connecticut, what it could mean for you here in the state, that's next on Ed Says. When it comes to the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, there are a couple of options being floated out there right now. We'll get to that in a second. But according to a new report from Wallet Hub, Connecticut will be the 10th most affected state by the Affordable Care Act repeal. Massachusetts expected to be the most affected, Texas the least. As Trump signed an executive order that would minimize the economic burden, which sets it up for repeal. When it comes to what will happen, the analysts at Wallet Hub said they sought out to help consumers understand what that means or doesn't mean, depending on what they live. They compared the 50 states and District of Columbia across several metrics, including growth of insured rate and potential economic impact due to repeal of premium tax credits and Medicaid expansion. Connecticut finishing in the top half of states in every metric. For example, Connecticut would have the 23rd biggest growth in uninsured by 2019, the fifth largest uncompensated care growth by 2021, and the fourth biggest potential impact due to the premium tax credits and Medicaid expansion. Angela Matty, a professor and chair of healthcare management at Quinnipiac University, says it doesn't surprise her, saying that the metric about the increase in uncompensated care is really unsurprising because people without medical insurance end up seeking care they can't afford through the emergencies rooms, the hospital's emergency department, who is not allowed to refuse them service. And we saw this before. Or they will seek care for basic illnesses through the emergency departments. Using the emergency room as a primary care provider is costly. They will revisit the report once a replacement plan is agreed upon. These, to clarify, they are saying that this is the impact of the repeal, not the replacement, because that's the only part that there are details on. There are a couple of options when it comes to replacement of the Affordable Care Act. And I mentioned that I had gone to the emergency room back on New Year's Eve on the 31st. I got my bill for that, $3,500. Thankfully, my insurance covers an emergency room copay, so I am not paying $3,500. But it cost me that for a bag of fluid, and a nebulizer, an x-ray, and I would say 8 hours in the emergency room when I probably only needed to be there for two or three. Oh, and maybe some blood and other tests. So it ain't cheap. And the thing is, if people don't have coverage, that $3,500 bill wouldn't have been covered by insurance, and the hospital would have been left holding the bag on it, as if somebody goes in and doesn't have coverage but needs care, they can't refuse them. And this is what we're talking about. This is what the repeal will lead us to. Of course, we're waiting to see the details of the replacements. You've got Senator Bill Cassidy, Senator Susan Collins, Johnny Isaacson, and Shelley Moore Capito, all introducing the Patient Freedom Act of 2017. It's a proposal that partially repeals and replaces the Affordable Care Act. It combines features of the Health Care Accessibility, Empowerment, and Liberty Act. And it is a mix of one or the other. It's a few things. Under this act, states could keep the Affordable Care Act, kind of, if they want to, adopt an approach based on subsidized Roth HSAs, health savings accounts, or reject reform altogether. Seems like quite a few options, and I'm not sure how it will work, and I'm not really clear on HSAs. Let's go to Bob in Enfield. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Ed. When I had my problem, I went into an urgent care facility in Enfield, and they took an X-ray, and I got antibiotics and stuff. I'm just paying my $30 copay. It's a lot cheaper. Like emergency room, they charge you like 10 times more. It's really, they're trying to discourage people from going to emergency rooms, and I would suggest that.
Oh, yeah. I know the expense of it, and I'm lucky that I have coverage that makes it inexpensive, well, relatively inexpensive. I went because the symptoms I was exhibiting were similar to an incident that I had had years prior that had led me to the emergency room. In retrospect, had I known that they were just similar and not the same, I would have definitely gone to urgent care. But I have a feeling that urgent care would have sent me to the hospital anyway.
Well, they might have. I know my wife went in, and she had pneumonia. They did call an ambulance and took her to the hospital. I went in there as a precaution because I was feeling the same way and hacking at everything. And they took an X-ray, and they said, no, you don't have it. My cousin went in. She had walking pneumonia. They didn't admit her to the hospital because I guess her condition wasn't that bad. So, you know, if urgent care is right around the corner, it's a lot easier. Because I know emergency room, sometimes you got to wait 10 hours to get even looked at.
Oh, yeah, I had to wait quite a while. Yeah, it's never a pleasant experience. And I understand why, because it is an emergency room. And looking at what I was dealing with, it probably wasn't an emergency to them. And I can understand that. But at the same time, we have to worry about if we go back to what it was, which was people without any sort of coverage. Okay, we'll still be going there whether we like it or not, and then they can't pay, and then that's an expense that the hospital is left with. There's got to be a way to make it work, and I don't necessarily have the answers. I thank you for the call, 888-574-2723. There are ideas of the Roth HSA. HSAs are subject to taxation, and only investment income on the Roth HSA and withdrawals for health care expenditures are free from taxation. So there's a little stuff there. This Patient Freedom Act, the Patient Freedom Act will keep a few of the provisions from the Affordable Care Act, which, again, why repeal it when you can just make changes to it? But, again, I think the Republicans want to own this by saying Obama bad, what we're doing is good, but here's the list of things that will keep from the Affordable Care Act, and it's a lengthy list. Ban on lifetime annual limit and annual limits. Now, this is the PFA, mind you. This is just being floated out there, the Patient Freedom Act. Coverage of adult children until 26. Prohibition against excluding pre-existing conditions. Health status discrimination. Preventative service requirements. Discrimination on race, origin, sex, age, disability, mental health and substance abuse coverage, black lung benefits for coal miners, state innovation waivers, and federal marketplace for states that desire to use it. So it is, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 portions of the Affordable Care Act that will be kept under the PFA if it is passed. And again, this is just what I say. How much of the Affordable Care Act stays until it's kind of an edit of the Affordable Care Act rather than something new, a replacement? It's a revision. They're saying repeal and replace, but it's more like they're revising, at least in this case. Let's go to Bob and Haddam. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. And I just want to say that, where I work, there's a couple of friends of mine that they have, like, one has four kids, one has five, and they're on Husky, but they still go to the emergency room when the kids get a real bad cold, or like one of them has asthma, but it's not, and they'll go there, and they just, I don't know why they go there. I keep telling them, go to the immediate medical, but they just keep going back to the hospital.
And some people, you can't explain it to. Listen, hospitals are for, you're either going there to get treatment to keep something from killing you, you're going there and it's going to kill you, or you're going to get fixed for an injury. Everything else should go to either urgent care or your primary care, right?
Well, I agree with you, but it's just that somebody has to either explain this better, because they keep doing the same thing over and over. Now, the other thing on the Affordable Care Act, I just tried to call Texas because my wife's daughter lives in Texas, and try to get Obamacare. And then I looked at first, I started out in Connecticut to see how much the cost would be in Connecticut compared to Texas. Connecticut, for a single girl, 21 years old, I said making $10,000 a year, it's like the cheapest I could find was $390. With a like a $3,500 deductible. I couldn't understand some of the plans because some of them were $500 with a $6,500 deductible. Medication, forget it, and that's all basically she needs it for because she has some problems and she needs medication. But Texas, the only thing I could find in Texas was catastrophic for $38 a month and doesn't cover anything.
Yeah.
Catastrophic. Yeah, so when you start trying, and I, by the way, a year ago, I tried to get insurance for, and literally, I was on the phone for maybe 4 hours. I just gave up. I said, look, just the chance of you getting sick is slim. You know, yeah, you're going to have to suck it up for your medication. We'll help you out. But I couldn't believe it. I mean, and then she was still in school at that time, so she tried to get school. That was $300 and some odd a month, and only covered during the school year.
Oh, that's weird. And that's the thing, Bob.
No,
I thank you.
You gotta honestly go out. You gotta go out and price.
Yeah, it shouldn't be this difficult, Bob. Thank you for the call. It shouldn't be this difficult, and I will not say that the Affordable Care Act is perfect. The problem is that you've got some states that went with Medicaid expansion, some didn't. We need a universal solution, and whether that's single payer, whether it is opening it up to across state lines for competition, I don't think that's the case, because health insurance and the cost of health care are two different things, and the rising costs, it's like student loans. Like the cost of schooling keeps going up because the money is there, and we have to rethink the whole thing. 888-574-2723, the number into the studio. Up next, we're going to talk to Fox News Radio's Evan Brown about a CDC report on adults and sugary drinks. Coming up, Evan Brown from Fox News Radio will be joining us to talk about this CDC report on sugary drinks. U.S. dietary guidelines have been urging Americans to drink less sugary beverages, and we have been listening. After a decade of falling consumption numbers, those numbers have stalled out, and they have stalled out above the recommended limit, according to statistics released by the CDC. What does that mean? Adults and children are consuming the same number of calories from soda, sports drinks, and other sugary beverages as we did in 2009 to 2010, which is the last time they published this data. Now, I love sweets. I love Oreos, I love ice cream, I love sodas, give me a Cherry Coke. I was addicted to Red Bull. But the amount of sugar we are consuming can be problematic. And according to a professor of nutrition at the University of Vermont and a spokesperson for the American Heart Association, Rachel Johnson, saying the amount of sugar that children in particular consume is still astounding. They recommend children drink one soda a week or less, and they're seeing two-thirds drink it on a daily basis, which is insane. I don't think my kid has had soda yet. If he did, it's a sip. And when he took a sip, I think he had one sip and we were like, oh, gross, yucky. He gets apple juice, which we cut with water because of the sugar content. Joining us now is Fox News Radio's Evan Brown. Good morning, Evan. How's it going?
Good morning.
What did you have to drink this morning?
I had a nice healthy water, didn't you?
Oh, look at that. I did have water because an orange juice, which is probably sugary, but at least there's some vitamin C. I kicked my Red Bull habit. I was a 12-ounce can a day.
Oh, I could never drink that stuff.
Well, I wasn't a coffee drinker, and I needed the caffeine.
Now that I can drink.
See, I needed the caffeine, so I went Red Bull, and I'm talking a decade, probably. And I got sick towards the end of last year, and I was going to give it up anyway, and being sick kind of helped. I've dropped 15 pounds, partially because of the sickness, but partially because I'm no longer taking in those empty calories and that sugar.
Right. Well, when we talk about sugary drinks, we're not really talking about juices. I mean, most fruit juices have sugar, but they're naturally sugar, sugar-fied, if you will. We're talking about sugar added to drinks, specifically things like soda, like energy drinks, like things that are not labeled as fruit juice, but fruit drinks, and even flavored waters. Those have added sugar, and what we've been able to see from the latest round of statistics counting and whatnot compiled by the National Center for Health Statistics, which is part of the CDC, is that almost two-thirds of boys and girls in the United States are having at least one sugary drink per day, and 10% of them, that's one out of every 10, are having three or more.
Holy cow!
Of sugar.
That's absurd.
And then, of course, if we look at the adults, we're looking at about a half of adults, men and women, having at least one of those a day. Again, that's a lot of sugar to take in. And sugar in this form, as we know, can lead to obesity, can lead to kidney problems, can lead to diabetes later in life, and other things. So it just further demonstrates that we do have an affinity for sugary drinks and things that are generally unhealthy for us.
So I can remember as a kid, and I do think that a kid having two or three sodas a day is absurd, but I can remember pouring my bowl of Cheerios, or heaven forbid my mom picked up a box of Kix, and I would just put spoonfuls of sugar to make it taste good, to the point where the remaining milk was more of a slurry of sugar milk than it was anything else. And I'm relatively still in decent shape. I probably have an extra 10 pounds I could shed. So with the kids, I don't worry that much, but is there an addiction factor? Is
well,
sugar?
It's not so much an addiction factor, but it's a lifestyle, factor and, a habit factor, because if you grow up taking in all this sugar and it's just the thing you do, that's what you're going to do going into adulthood, and that's going to result in health problems. You are going to have a higher chance of obesity, and obesity brings with it things like fatty liver disease, cardiac disease, and then issues regarding your ability to process all that sugar and fat, and that's what we call diabetes.
Wow, I have FDL.
And so this is about lifestyle choices more than it is addiction. We could argue that there's an addiction to sugar or addiction to sodas, and I think a lot of people who do drink that stuff, and I will put myself in there. I mean, you know, you can just go grab one can of a soda after another, and before you know it, you've had six or seven, and it's only noon.
The thing is, we're so, I mean, Coca-Cola, think about it, is America. Like, they sell us on the experience being at a ball game or whatever, like, that's cracking a Coke on a summer day. It's no more American than that.
Well, look, those are companies that are marketing their products, and we have the First Amendment, so they can do that. But if we look at the origin of things like sodas, and I don't want to, really focus it solely on Coca-Cola, though they are obviously the most recognized brand of soda and most recognized brand of anything, really. You know, when soda pop was first developed, you know, you didn't have it for sale in the grocery stores that you could take it home and have it in your fridge. You didn't have it in vending machines. You didn't have it basically everywhere you went. You had to go to a soda shop. So it was sort of a thing that you did. It was an activity. You bonded over it. You went out for a soda. That's how things were. I mean, like 100 years ago. Flash forward today, you have much more access to those types of confectioneries, if you will. Now you just have it in your home fridge, and you have a lot of it.
So it's one of those things that we've gotten so used to consuming when it used to be something special. But I think everything's turned that way. Think about ice cream, and think about movies, and just simply entertainment. We don't have to leave our houses for anything special anymore, really.
Well, that might be a good thing for a lot of people. But, you know, it comes down really to choices. You know, certainly no one's making you buy the soda or the energy drink or you know, it does. I don't want to just, again, put the blame solely on soda.
Right.
This does come down to the choices you make for yourself and really for your children. You know, when we're talking about the children in the survey, we're talking about kids as young as 4. They don't have their own money to go buy soda.
That's incredible to me. I'm going to keep mine away from it as much as I can. And like I said, I give them juice, but I still cut it with water. Like you said, juice isn't considered a sugary beverage. But yeah, I still cut it.
For the purposes of this study, it isn't. But yes, there are naturally occurring sugars in natural, 100% natural fruit juices. I think the greatest example would be orange juice. And I know many people who do need to watch their sugar, and they do love orange juice. And yes, they do. They split it 50-50 with water.
Well, Eben Brown from Fox News Radio, hopefully you're going to get your coffee black and not loaded up with sugars and creams.
All natural turbinado sugar for me.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
You got it, man.
Take care. 888-574-2723. I mean, I had a friend who lived on the dew. Like, he would drink 3 or 4 a day, and I think it eventually caught up with him. Eben mentioned fatty liver disease, which is interesting because that's something I was diagnosed with, and I just caught my ear. It has since been corrected. I think that was mostly based on living too close to my favorite bar and imbibing in far too many delicious heavy beers, along with the energy drinks and along with the diet. But a lot has changed since 2009 when that happened. And, you know, I've gotten married. I've had a kid. I've gotten older. When you're young and invincible, you don't think about those things. You know, when you're in your 20s, you're like, oh, this isn't going to hurt me. I'll, 10 years ago, I was cracking Red Bulls. I'd have 2 a day some days. Let's go to Bob in Suffield. It is the day of Bob's. Good morning, Bob. How's it going?
Good morning. How you doing, Ed?
Doing all right.
Good. I just want to give you a little insight on sugar content in kids.
Yeah.
I got 3 grandchildren, and they started drinking, you know, regular water. I gave them, like, purified distilled water. And one is 7, the other one's 6, and the other one's 4. And they never have that much sugar, you know, that it's taboo, you know. And you look at the results of what they give them, vegetables and a real good thirst. Kids love vegetables. Parents don't understand. They'd rather have carrots and Brussels sprang up on it more than McDonald's. When I take my grandchildren to the park to play, I have vegetables with me. The other kids come over and they devour it, you know. So I just thought I'd give you some insight that they never get sick. They have a good immune system. I mean, they get sick, but for a short period of time. So I just wanted to reflect on the sugar content in kids and what the stuff for my grandchildren.
Yeah, we got to be we have to be careful about it. I thank you for the call. I do the same thing. Like I said, he definitely doesn't get soda. He gets juice, which I still cut with water. We try the vegetables. Like, he likes cucumbers. He likes red peppers and green peppers. He gets plenty of fruit, which, again, is sugar, but a naturally occurring sugar. It's not added. He's a big fan of, man, that kid loves bananas. He would eat bananas every day for every meal if we let him get away with it. And it's just, it's about, and we give him vegetables, you know, carrots, peas. He eats those. Sometimes begrudgingly. Sometimes he doesn't even know. Sometimes he inhales them. But he also has a sweet tooth. He has his mother's sweet tooth. The kid loves Swedish fish, and he loves cupcakes. And I don't think you necessarily have to deny them of things like that. I think it's more about, you know, it's like anything. Balance. Moderation. You know, doing anything too much is bad for you. And like I said the other day, I don't have any vices anymore. I don't smoke. I barely drink, and I certainly don't drink like I used to. I gave up my energy drinks, so I don't have caffeine. I don't have nicotine. I don't have alcohol. I've become what a young me would call boring, but I feel good, so I got that going for me. Get ready. This is the segment in which I have under 7 minutes before my next break. It's a hard break that I have to hit, so that's all the time I will be dedicating towards criticism of our president today. For those of you that are like, what? What? I just want to touch on some statistics. You can take them as you will. Because Trump is moving forward with the wall. How it will be paid for, still up in the air, as Mexico says they will not. But I want you to know the number of undocumented individuals crossing the border into the United States has reached a 40-year low and has been on the decline since 2000. We're looking at under a quarter of a million people of U.S. apprehensions of undocumented immigrants by nationality. Quarter of a million people in 2014. In 2000, almost 1.75 million. So the numbers have dropped steeply. And it's been a trend. It's not as though this is a blip. They've been dropping since 2000. They went up a bit in 04, but not to the levels of 2000. And then they will go down. And I bring this up because while it's a rallying point, they took our jobs. It's not necessarily a need. It reminds me of my old neighborhood. My parents moved to Connecticut a few years ago to be closer to me and my sister who lives in the city. And in our old cul-de-sac, when I would go to visit, there was an individual who lived across the street. And he had dogs. And his neighbor had dogs, larger dogs. And while his neighbor's dogs, two houses over, got out and attacked and killed at least one, if not two, of his dogs. And his response was to build, he's probably still building it, I never saw it finished, a cinder block wall with gates around his property. Well, that wall's not going to bring back those dogs. And that reaction isn't going to fix anything. The problem isn't the need of a wall, is that those other dogs need to be removed. With the removal of the dogs, that threat has gone. But he continued to build this wall, and I never saw it finished. I would hope it's finished by now, because my parents have been here for a few years. I haven't been back to my hometown since they left. Maybe I'll check it out next time I'm there. But the idea that we need this wall when the numbers have dropped so much at the expense it will be is just ludicrous. We don't need it. Again, I mentioned this before. Most people who are here illegally come on legal visas and don't leave. And most of them come by plane, which, I hate to break it to you, can go over walls. There isn't a wall high enough yet to stop a plane. So the border isn't the issue. But we're going to spend billions of dollars to keep under a quarter of a million people out of this country when the vast majority of them come in another way. And this isn't partisan. This is common sense. If you think that illegal immigrants are a problem, it isn't those crossing the border. Not anymore. It is those overstaying visas. So that's something to think about as we move forward with the wall based on the president's wishes. The other problem is that he is asking for the major investigation into widespread voter fraud, saying 3 to 5 million voters voted illegally. Now, he also mentioned people who registered in two states. It's not illegal to be registered in two states, but he mentioned that particularly, not voting in two states, but being registered, even though his daughter and two of his staff are just that, registered in two states. It is illegal to vote in two states, not illegal to be registered. But what the problem is we will probably see harsher laws come down when our Supreme Court has been fighting against them in other states like Texas and North Carolina. It's going to make it hard for people to vote. Maybe not you, but this isn't about you. This is about removing you from your experience and seeing that somebody might have it harder than you. And there will be more restrictive laws and less democracy. And if you don't have a problem with that, then you're un-American. Because there is no in-person voter fraud happening. Period. These voter ID laws and making it more difficult is a solution, again, for a problem that doesn't exist. And this comes down to a matter of reality. Now, there are rumors that this major investigation was fueled by a, quote, friend of Donald Trump who just happens to be a golfer who can't vote in the United States. He said his story was told by his friend Bernard Langer. He says that Langer told him while he was standing in line he would not be able to vote. But Langer's not a U.S. citizen. And that there were others who were Latino who could vote. And apparently part of what Langer said, according to him, was voters who did not look like as if they should be allowed to vote. Did not look like should not be a motivating factor in making laws.